What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Lane Davis, and I'm your host for today's podcast. Today, I have the privilege of talking with Nicholas Pruitt, Assistant Professor of Humanities at Eastern Nazarene College, about his new book, Open Hearts, Closed Doors, Immigration Reform and the Waning of Mainline Protestantism, published by New York University Press. The book uncovers the largely overlooked role that mainline Protestant churches and their leaders had in developing concepts of cultural pluralism in America in the 20th century through missionary work and legislative activism. Dr. Pruitt, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you, Lane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. So first question, the title of your book, I think, frames the argument you're making really well. Explain to us what it means that mainline Protestants in the 20th century often had open hearts towards immigrants and displaced persons, but were often more reluctant to fully open the doors of the nation to those seeking a new home.
Sure. Yes. The argument is that as we often like to say in history, it's messy, it's complicated, and my kind of target subjects were white Protestants in America, especially those who identify with some of the leading Protestant denominations or groups within the nation. And once I started researching and looking, I discovered some openness and even some moderate to progressive views on, say, immigration reform, even multiculturalism at times. But there were definitely limits to that, and those limitations are often tied to white Protestants still wanting to maintain a nation where they maintain their kind of cultural hegemony, as many historians say. And want to, as I discussed, they still want to be cultural gatekeepers. So they want immigration and a multicultural or diverse nation on their own terms. And so it's a back and forth throughout the book. But my hope is to, kind of complicate how we view white Protestants, especially those tied to these mainline traditions within the 20th century.
Now, the main groups you look at are the mainline Protestants, which generally get defined as sort of the seven sisters. I always leave one out when I try and name them. But basically, Methodists, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, Presbyterians. You also include Southern Baptists, though, which may have been an interesting choice. What was sort of your criteria for the groups that you looked at?
Sure. Yeah, I looked at, we do have some religious census material in the early 20th century. And so I looked at, which groups were in terms of membership, were more numerically predominant. And so I picked, the top three or four of those. And then I included Southern Baptist, and I make the disclaimer in the book, obviously they should not be identified as mainline Protestant. They definitely don't collaborate in ecumenical work with other more moderate to progressive leaning Protestants. But because of their numerical predominance, I mean, by the mid to late 20th century, they are the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. And so, and the fact that they, especially in the South, Southwest, even Southeast, maintain important kind of cultural power, basically. And so I felt like I definitely needed to include them. I was doing graduate work in Texas at the time at Baylor University, so I also had good access to Southern Baptist sources down there. And so I decided to include them in the project.
Excellent. Well, I thought it was a good choice. It really made the narrative sort of much wider than it might have otherwise been. So excellent work. The book follows a chronological narrative, so I'll kind of stick to that in asking some questions. You write that in the 1920s that Protestants supported vibrant home mission programs for immigrant communities, and that activism actually helped to temper, though it certainly didn't eliminate, nativist sentiments in the pews. Explain exactly how that worked during that time period, if you can.
Oh, sure, definitely. I think that's a great question. I think this is just a plug here. I think home missions are one of the most overlooked topics in American religion and cultural history. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done there in kind of dissecting and analyzing home mission programs that really run the gamut. They are addressing so many different ethnic, racial, cultural, national groups within the nation, and speak a lot to how white Protestants who are running these missions programs, how they perceive who they consider outsiders, basically, at the time. So I think it's a really rich source material, and I there has been some small gains there in the historiography, but I felt like I had a pretty open door here to look at home missions, but especially mission programs that were targeting immigrants and then later displaced people and refugees as well. And so, I think they are a rich source material because they really speak to the cultural commitments and the theological and spiritual commitments of these Protestant home missionaries. And I make it clear, and I think most of us religious historians will recognize, there's never a strong dichotomy between the sacred and the secular. And these home mission programs really blur religious missional agendas with cultural impulses. And so, for instance, in the 20s, assimilation and Americanization programs are predominant, not only in religious circles, but social service circles as well throughout the nation, as the nation is making adjustments and responding to the millions of new immigrants coming from the turn of the 20th century. And so these Americanization and assimilation programs really speak a lot to how white Protestants define what they believe it is to be American, and the hopes and expectations they place upon people migrating to the United States. Now, one argument I make, and it's not a new argument, there are historians who have made this argument in other contexts as well, and that is just the formative role of missions, whether it's foreign or home missions. Oftentimes, missionaries go through a transition. Once they start living and immersing themselves in other cultures, it's not always the case, but in some cases, they grow more tolerant or more open to accepting kind of a multicultural understanding. And I found a similar trajectory in many of the sources I looked at. There is a really an intense evangelistic mission for sure to convert immigrants to these Protestant traditions. But there is this kind of growing respect for the cultures, even the languages that are brought over within these immigrant communities. And these Protestant missionaries are really trying to navigate the complexities of assimilation or cultural retention and presenting their Christian message in that context. And so obviously nativism, as you pointed out in the book, is not wiped out entirely. I mean, that is a long tradition among white Protestants that they're, you know, still working to relinquish. But I think there are some meager steps made during this time to at least understand and respect cultural diversity. Religious diversity, however, is another issue. And I try to make that distinction in the book. These home missionaries are much more comfortable with cultural diversity, not so much with religious diversity, because they still think of the United States as a Protestant nation, in essence.
Yeah. Well, and we'll get into some of that too, I think. Now, in your third chapter, you title it the Trying 30s. It was a period when social gospel principles were diffusing through Protestant congregations. Explain what that process means, the diffusion process of social gospel principles into mainline Protestantism during that time.
Sure. Yeah, that's my book in part is meant to be a contribution to immigration history, but it's also my attempt at providing some contributions to religious history, especially the history of mainline liberal progressive traditions in the United States. And so, especially chapters 2 and 3, I get into the social gospel, and I, you know, maybe start wading through some of the theology, hopefully the religious historians really check in there, and maybe the immigration historians tend to kind of, you know, check out at that point. But I had some things I wanted to say about these religious traditions, the main white mainline Protestants. And as we know, the social gospel movement there at the turn of the 20th century, largely kind of infusing a more kind of kingdom-centered, liberal, more modern take on theology, but meant to address the structural and social problems of the day, and probably epitomized in the Settlement House movement at the turn of the century. And what I trace is how those ideals, social gospel ideals of creating social justice, harmony, but also through a Christian lens in society, how those continue to be carried and practiced within these Protestant traditions. And oftentimes these ideas are interpreted by historians as being kind of at the upper crust of these denominations. So leaders who are seminary trained, who've really bought into a more liberal or modernist theology, you know, they're the ones who really promote the social gospel. But the average person in the pew doesn't have that training, that background, and may have more of a disconnect. Now, what I'm arguing is these social gospel ideas kind of trickle down over the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and are kind of repackaged by the laity sitting in the pews of these Protestant churches. And it doesn't look exactly like the social gospel written in the books of, say, a Walter Rauschenbusch or a Jane Addams, but there I really trace the lineage of certain terminology, like the brotherhood of man. That phrase, which has a lot of historical origins, but is an important commonplace phrase in the social gospel movement, that continues to be used throughout these home missions materials, even political statements. Even President Harry Truman even uses that vocabulary in some of his speeches later on. So that diffusion is basically my argument that these social gospel ideas, they're not transferred in a pure form, but they do begin to be diffused or spread out through larger pockets of kind of white Protestant mainline traditions. And what that looks like is it is a a weird kind of mixing of more kind of presentist, this worldly theology, trying to fix social problems and inequities today. But when the laity start grappling with those ideas, they're also firmly committed to a more traditional evangelistic approach as well. They don't dispense with trying to preach, you know, the gospel, the Christian tradition. And so that diffusion means that those two ideals, social and evangelistic aspirations, that I wouldn't say they're wed, but they kind of work together, and they're both kind of embraced by these home mission societies. I was fascinated looking at home missions records, pamphlets from local churches. And oftentimes these are women's groups. And my best example would be a Northern Baptist pamphlet, which I guess this was probably a little further ahead in the 1950s, but so it would have been American Baptist. But they, in the same pamphlet, they're talking about writing your congressman, advocating for immigration reform, working towards more liberal immigration policy. But in that same pamphlet, they're also saying, oh, and go find someone who is an immigrant in your community and share Jesus Christ with them as well. For me, that really paints the picture of this kind of interplay of the social gospel and traditional evangelism within these groups.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So then to switch back to sort of the immigration part of this, why were the 1930s a trying period for immigrant missions?
Probably the most obvious reason is immigration numbers themselves are drastically reduced. This is in part due to the restrictive laws that were passed in the 20s, but also due to the economic crisis of the 1930s. And at one point, we have more people leaving the country than entering in the kind of mid-30s. So there are less people migrating, entering into the country. But I do think that's a little complicated. That doesn't mean home missions to immigrants just end during that period. Because in fact, you still have three or four decades prior where we had large numbers of immigrants coming into the United States. And those communities are still there, and they still maintain cultural and kind of immigrant identities. And these Protestant missionaries are still recognizing their presence and working with them, even if further immigration is not really happening in the 1930s. Another kind of twist or layer to this would be by the late 1930s, we begin to see particularly the Jewish refugee crisis in Germany. And we see a few, not many, unfortunately, but a few Protestant voices identifying that refugee crisis and wanting to see relief provided to Jews and even some German Christians who are trying to flee Nazi Germany. So there's a growing awareness of refugee crises around the world too.
Right. I want to focus then on World War II. That produced an interesting period for Protestant immigrant missions that you note, because you note that toleration and unity were elevated together. And you have this quote. You say, earlier concerns over immigrant hordes coming to dilute the Anglo-Saxon racial order in America dissipated as political ideologies were seen as the primary threat. And it's even resulted in some initial challenges to the American racial order that you talk about. So discuss a little bit about this period and how Protestants balance those competing notions of toleration and unity.
Many sources at this time, and once again, I'm not the first historian to recognize this, but many Americans in general are growing more and more concerned about fascism and communism and socialism, which, those have been concerns even prior to World War II, for sure. But those are seen as the kind of the primary threats to the United States and its well-being and its identity. And this is, to be clear, this is not to say that racist understandings, white supremacy, are kind of tossed by the wayside. Those are still very tragic currents, strong currents in American culture. But I would say the attention of American society is more turned less to maybe its ethnic, racial, national diversity within the nation, and focused more on these external threats like communism and Hitler's Germany. And you even see some more openness to discussing American racism during and after World War II, especially once various concentration camps are liberated and Americans begin to learn of the horrors of Nazi Germany and its racism, and this concern of that we don't want to replicate that. Add to the fact that the Soviet Union is also more than willing to point out America's failures in racism within the early Cold War, right after World War II. And so I think I would argue, and other historians argue, there's kind of a more growing recognition that Americans need to confront their racist demons and the racist structures and practices and laws in the nation. Now, obviously, there are, as civil rights historians will say, there are a lot more factors that go into play in that. But I do think there is a, if you try to gain the social pulse of that time, cultural pulse, people are more open to discussing race and racism in America. And I find that many of my subjects, particularly mainline leaders who are at the forefront of these denominations or home mission societies or the National Council of Churches, they are fostering these conversations, and they often try to lump things together and say, we want to address racism in America, but racism not only directed towards African Americans, but also against people of other national identities, and occasionally even addressing anti-Semitism in America. There's just, more openness, especially people at the top of these denominations, to address prejudice during the World War II era. It's becoming a more pertinent topic to them at the time, even though I think we could all agree that it's a little too late and too short. They should have been addressing that much earlier, but World War II gives at least some momentum to those conversations.
Right, exactly. Now, it seems that you suggest, and correct me if I get this wrong, but it seems that you suggested the 1950s were largely a period of continuity in Protestant immigrant missions, though the context were certainly changing. You talk about a new media environment, the rise of the Cold War, as well as some changing attitudes about pluralism. So give us an overview, if you will, of sort of what was happening in the 1950s and what immigrant missions looked like then.
Sure. Well, one kind of impetus for this whole project itself is when I started this project back in 2011, the historiography largely kind of skips over, especially the history of immigration in America, really skips over this period. You know, people say, well, immigration ends in 1924 and is kind of revived in 1965 with Johnson's reforms. There are several other important historians who have also are drawing more attention to this period. It's a very formative period in not only policy, but American, especially white American perceptions and responses to immigration. It's not put on halt during this era of restriction. There's a lot to be unpacked. And especially in the 1950s, not only are you seeing refugee resettlement programs that the government is calling for and sponsoring, but you see calls for immigration reform, attempts to overturn the quota system that preferences some nationalities and even racial groups over others. And it's a pretty fierce kind of political debate in the early 1950s. And in 1952, with the McCarran-Walter Act, basically the voices of restriction are able to kind of maintain a more restrictive system into the early 1960s. But these white mainline Protestants are a really important part of the kind of activist front calling for immigration reform and saying, yeah, our immigration system is very racist. And they start with by looking at Asian exclusion. And when that's Chinese exclusion is overturned in World War II, and then Japanese exclusion, the final piece of Asian exclusion is overturned in the early 50s. That's kind of their first step. White Protestants are acknowledging, yeah, that is racist. We are targeting a group of people, restricting them based upon their racial identity. But from there, they then also begin to look at how groups from South and Eastern Europe are also being discriminated in that quota system, which is something we all teach in our history classes today. But it took white Protestants and probably American culture in general a while to really understand maybe what those legislators were doing in the 1920s. I mean, they knew what they were doing. They did not want to see further Jewish and Italian immigration and Eastern European immigrants. But many Americans, especially white Protestants, it took them a while to kind of connect the dots, unfortunately. And it's really not until the 50s that they recognize, oh, I did not, this is maybe one critique of myself, I don't know if that's fair or not, but one thing I suggest in the book, if I had it to do over again, I would want to flesh this out more, is I do think there is a connection with this is kind of ties into Matthew Jacobson's work on how different immigrant groups become white or perceived as white in America. By the 1950s, a lot of the Southeastern European groups that were racialized as other in the early 20th century, thinking of Italians, for instance, by the mid-20th century, you know, American culture in general kind of accepts them as white. And I wonder if there is a correlation there for their acceptance and categorization as white and this growing concern for their discrimination in current immigration policy in the 50s. Lane, does that answer your question?
Interesting. Future work to future articles to get to work on right there. Yeah, absolutely. So I want to focus just a little bit on refugees or displaced persons, as they were called. You note that there was a relationship going on between settlement mission work, legislation that was going through Congress during the time, as well as civil rights. I guess, can you explain that a little bit? Did the white Protestants you focus on, did they treat refugees differently than other types of immigrants who were coming into the nation? Mm.
Yes and no, in a sense. I would first like to point out, though, that even this issue of refugee resettlement, we don't escape the issue of race and racism. I think it's important to recognize that which refugee groups are the United States, is the United States really working to resettle? And it's largely European groups coming from either Germany or other parts of war-torn Europe at that time. And it definitely gets woven into this response to Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe and a response to the Cold War. But these are largely European refugees. Now, to be clear, there are many other refugee crises around the world, but I do think there is a clear favoritism to these European displaced people. And kind of the assumption is that the United States government sees them as, in their eyes, fitting better into assimilating better into American society or more deserving based upon simply racism at this time than other refugee groups around the world. So, yeah, race is there for sure. And it's important to note who they're working to resettle. It's a very limited scope there, a very racialized scope at that. But I think there is a lot of kind of continuity here in terms of how they respond to displaced people and refugees. They, especially by the 1950s, are working to receive them, to care for them. A part of the resettlement program at that time involved a community, a town, or a family signing up with the government, and they had to basically find the refugee family that they're sponsoring a job, housing. And it's interesting looking, this is another great area for further research. The American Baptist Archives in Atlanta have literally boxes upon boxes of note cards of refugee families that were sponsored. And it's a wealth of information that speaks to these refugee families and their religious identities, where they're coming from, and who was sponsoring them. And when you look at some of the kind of anecdotal stories and accounts, you see local church communities donating furniture, or in one case, I found a church in Newton, Massachusetts that I think it was an immigrant family. They found the husband a job at a local power electric company. And so you see a willingness there to respond to this need. And you see, once again, a marginal respect for the cultural diversity of trying to understand these people, while also hoping that this kind of kind gesture of resettlement will ensure these people will, you know, think seriously about joining Protestant churches once they're in the United States. So it is missional still, while also being a kind of humanitarian concern as well. But it's really interesting because, I mean, you know, especially as we know today, refugee resettlement is a very controversial topic. And there were sources even in the 50s talking about the tension between local communities who just see refugees as people who are going to take jobs or that are they're an economic threat to Americans. And some of these more progressive white Protestant ministers are trying to counteract those arguments. And probably one of the more fascinating sources I stumbled upon in the archives was a 30-minute video segment that the Methodist Church produced. And it basically, I compare it to the Andy Griffith Show in Mayberry. It looks like the same set, basically. In fact, one of the actors from the Andy Griffith Show is actually in this episode. And in this episode, you have a traveling journalist or correspondent. I think he's probably like maybe Western or Eastern German coming through, and his car breaks down. And it just so happens that the local community, the local church, is considering sponsoring a refugee family. But you've got this one guy in the community who just sees them as a threat. But he starts talking with this journalist who is a different nationality, and he realizes, oh, we have a lot in common. So it's kind of a morality tale in this 30-minute episode. But in that episode, a lot of the themes, even some of the vocabulary of the social gospel, are present in that video. And it was, one of those moments where, you know, you're trudging through the archives and you stumble across something like that, and it just was like, you know, finding gold basically in the archives.
Right. Wow. So in one of your last chapters, you start to deal with sort of expanding notions of pluralism that were taking hold in the 1960s. And you really turned your attention to how Protestants were really sort of activist in terms of certain pieces of legislation. One of the stories that you tell that I found really interesting was the story of the McCarran-Walter Act. You mentioned it earlier. I wondered if you could tell that story a little bit more in depth. Tell us about that act and sort of how Protestants reacted to that.
Sure. Yeah. So, the McCarran-Walter Act is passed, I believe, in 1952, and there had been a year or so of debate in Congress, and Pat McCarran and Walter, I forget his first name, but congressman from Pennsylvania, Francis Walter, they are both very conservative. They are concerned about American identity. They want to respond to problems in this kind of post-war era, but they have a very kind of white Anglo-Saxon vision for the nation. And they think liberalizing immigration policy is going to weaken American identity, American culture. Having said that, they do recognize there are some immediate problems. So, for instance, Japanese exclusion, the final act that's passed, which is basically maintains a more restrictive status quo, it does actually overturn Japanese exclusion. You know, that's one of the one kind of, you know, maybe kind of positive things we can draw from that legislation. But the rest of the legislation largely continues favoring some nationalities over others and keeping a very restrictive quota system. And many activists, lobbyists at the time, they knew that. In fact, there were other members of Congress who were advocating for more liberal reform. And many more progressive liberal Protestant leaders were backing another political alternative, another bill that was being considered, which didn't pass. And so they really saw this as kind of waging a political war to try to liberalize immigration reform. And so it's in large part a lost effort in 52 when the McCarran-Walter Act is passed. But you see the Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant Christians really begin to work together to advocate for immigration reform. And while it's a defeat there in 52, they gain a lot of momentum. And there's a book that came out a couple of years ago that really traces this well, called Unwanted, by Dr. Marianani. My apologies if I mispronounce her name, but it's a really helpful text looking at, in particular, at Italian and Jewish mobilization around immigration reform at this time. And so Protestants are by no means the only voice calling for reform, but these mainline, more progressive Protestants are jumping in and are working to, at first, counteract McCarran-Walter, and then eventually try to overturn it or continue to work at creating a more equal immigration system. Now, I should point out, their goal is to overturn an immigration system which is codified in the 1924 laws and continued in 52 with the McCarran-Walter Act. They want to overturn a system that allows for unequal quotas. So if you're coming from Britain or France or Scandinavia, there are larger quotas that are allowed to migrate on a yearly basis, as opposed to people coming from Asia or Eastern Europe. They want to level the playing field, basically, and not discriminate based upon nationality. What they are not advocating for, however, is drastically increasing immigration. They don't want to invite more people. They just want to admit people on a more equal, less discriminatory basis. And that's what they're really coming to work towards by the 1960s. Now, the McCarran-Walter Act, it's a fascinating piece of political history that overlaps with religious history. A lot of these denominations print very interesting and elaborate pamphlets that they are working to distribute among their Protestant constituents to try to convince them to write their congressmen and push back against the McCarran-Walter Act. And there are really fascinating artifacts from this period to look at in the archives.
So one final question, and this kind of goes back to the title of your book. One of the themes running through is how the limited acceptance of a pluralist society really sowed the seeds of mainline Protestantism's eventual decline. Can you explain that process a bit and how you describe that as the narrative of the book runs through?
Sure. Yeah, so mainline Protestants are, by the start of the 20th century, these white mainline groups that are historically traced their origins back into the 18th, you know, even sometimes 17th centuries, or I'm sorry, 18th and 19th centuries, they have grown accustomed to largely defining American culture. And I start my book with the example of, you know, largely Protestant school prayer at the beginning of the century. You know, that all changes by the time you get to 1970s, 1980s. There is more of a growing understanding of, yeah, we are a multicultural nation. And we are a religiously diverse nation as well. And so over the course of the 20th century, when I refer to mainline decline, I'm referring to their decline in society and culture. I'll let other historians, you know, sift through the numerical decline of the mainline denominations, but I'm largely speaking to their kind of cultural clout that really begins to dissipate by the end of the century. And I would argue that comes in part because they've been advocating for, at least by the 1950s and 60s, cultural pluralism, and earlier a form of cosmopolitanism, using the vocabulary of historian David Hollinger. Those ideas become embraced more broadly within America, and we'll see with immigration reform in 1965, other parts of the world are more able to immigrate to the United States. And we see important increases in people migrating from Asia or Latin America by the 70s and 80s. And, you know, that begins to change the tenor of American culture, American identity, and more people are beginning to grapple with and understand, yeah, we are a nation of diversity, multiculturalism. Now, many people, white Americans, may not like that, but they're having to come to grips with that. And even the kind of cliche, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, which, you know, that is a term that originates in the 1950s and 60s debates. And some historians have shown also is largely speaking to our European immigrant heritage. But that vocabulary becomes more commonplace by the late 20th century. And so what I argue is the flip side is mainline Protestants are no longer at the helm of American culture and society. They're no longer really gatekeepers any longer. They have to take a step back and more fully embrace and accept the diversity that has come to really define the United States by the end of the 20th century. And not everyone, even within mainline traditions, are going to support that. In fact, I still think there is a gap between the laity and the clergy on that matter. There, I think, were some progressive impulses among the laity, but generally, many of them still don't want to see increased immigration and major changes to what they perceive to be American identity, even though their pastors or denominational leaders are fully on board with a more kind of multicultural perspective. So yeah, I speaking to their decline, you could also make a point we have new sources of immigration begins to be less of a European and more of an Asian and Latin American phenomenon in the United States. And with that comes, mentioned sub-Saharan Africa, with that comes new forms of Christianity that are brought with these groups of people. And I mentioned this briefly at the end, this could be another possible future project for someone out there, but is looking at how the evangelicalism that is brought from various immigrant groups from, say, Latin America or Korea or sub-Saharan Africa, how that challenges the kind of mainline Protestant tradition as well. As we know, by the 70s and 80s, with the rise of the religious right and the 1976, the year of the evangelical, evangelicals then become important social, cultural forces in the United States. And these mainline Protestants really kind of take a back seat after that. And I think, yeah, there is some correlation there between rising immigration rising numbers of immigrants bringing their evangelical Christianity, and they don't quite find a home in the more kind of moderate liberal tradition in certain mainline churches.
Right. Well, Dr. Pruitt, it is a fascinating story and a fascinating book. We thank you so much for your time today and especially for these in-depth answers on this subject. If people want to follow your work, where's the best place to find you?
Sure. Let me first just point out, I just really thank the New Books Network for what they do. I've been a longtime listener. I have my students listen to podcasts through the New Books series. And I just want to thank you, Lane, and others in the network for what they do. That's an important service to the academic community. If you want to find my work, I'm active on Twitter. You can do a search for my name, Nicholas Pruitt. You can access my book on Amazon or through the NYU Press page. And I would be more than welcome to receive emails with thoughts, critiques, even from people who have either listened to the podcast or read the book.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Nicholas Pruitt is Assistant Professor of Humanities at Eastern Nazarene College, and his book that we've discussed today is Open Hearts, Closed Doors, Immigration Reform, and the Waning of Mainline Protestantism, published by New York University Press in 2021, and as Dr. Pruitt mentioned, available on Amazon or from the NYU Press website. Thanks again, Dr. Pruitt, for joining us. I hope we get to talk about more of these projects again sometime in the future.
It's been a pleasure, Lane.
And thank you for joining us on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Make sure to subscribe to our channel wherever you get your podcasts. We update every weekday with new interviews and content on the latest in academic and mainstream history publishing. Thanks for listening and happy reading.